Today, how life changed for Muslims in the UK after the 9/11 attacks. Sohaima Manzoor Khan grew up in Leeds in the early 1990s. As a child of second-generation British Pakistanis, there was always family around and they encouraged her to take every opportunity.
I tried everything, piano, tennis, cricket, swimming. I loved reading. I was trying to mould myself off Matilda. I watched that film probably like every single day for a couple of years.
Nabil Abdul Rashid grew up in northern Nigeria in the late 1980s. He moved to the UK as a teenager in the period after 9/11. And he knew what he wanted to do from a young age.
So my earliest childhood memory, I think I was about 4 or 5, is watching Richard Pryor do stand-up and thinking, wow, I don't know what this guy is doing, but I like it.
Today, Nabil is a stand-up comedian.
I refuse to show up my name because I think in this day and age, you don't even need to speak Arabic or be Muslim to know what my name means. The name Nabil Abdul Rashid basically means that my phone calls are monitored. So...
And Sohaima is an award-winning published poet.
So in the end, prevent is nothing but political deflection, proof that the state is headed in the most authoritarian direction. So prepare for permanent conditions of persecution, because even if it's not yet palpable to you, the project of resistance is your obligation too. Yeah, the project of resistance is your obligation too.
For both, and for millions of Muslims in the West and around the world, the attacks of September the 11th, 2001, were a before and after moment.
I was made aware that I was not a full American or not an average or normal American right after September 11th. It's like I went to sleep an American and I woke up an Arab, even though I was born and raised in America.
In the 20 years since 9/11, Muslims the world over have faced scrutiny and suspicion like never before. In the UK, the Prevent Counterterrorism strategy forced teachers to inform on students that they thought at risk of radicalisation. Anti-terrorism laws gave more powers to detain suspects, for longer, without charge. And studies have shown that most coverage of Muslims in the media has been relentlessly negative. Now, as the world marks the 20th anniversary of those terrible attacks, many Muslims are reflecting on what these past two decades have meant for them. From The Guardian, I'm Nosheen Iqbal. Today in Focus, a conversation about Islamophobia in the UK. After 9/11. Okay, so let's start with the fact that there's often this assumption that Muslims around the world, they all look the same, they all think the same, and there's this monolithic block. But actually, as you both prove, there's many different kinds of cultures and ethnicities. And in my experience, growing up in a British Pakistani household, I didn't realise how dominant the Pakistani culture element was in comparison to the actual religious bit. Sohaima, I'll come to you in a second, but first, Nabil, would you say your home was influenced more by Nigerian culture or by religious faith?
Looking back, I would say Nigerian culture and Islam probably would have been a 50-50 split in the way I was raised, because the Nigerian mentality is whatever you do, you have to be the best at. Some people call it arrogant, but Nigerians are raised to see ourselves as kings. From childhood, we're taught that we're great. In Nigeria, I come from a long line of people that I can name.
Religion still did play a big part in how I was raised. Growing up in a part of the world like northern Nigeria, it's like there's a mosque on every street. On Fridays, nobody locks their shops, you just go to the mosque.
Sohaima, same question for you. Was your household influenced more by British Pakistani culture, or was it more religious growing up?
It's hard to remember, but I wouldn't say I had a religious upbringing in any sense. I mean, my mum was literally, I think, 8 months old when she came to this country, and my dad was like 1 or something. So I feel like I was very much third generation, if you can call it that. And I think in that way, whatever we sort of associate with Pakistani British culture, I suppose was definitely there in my upbringing. You know, I grew up very much around my grandparents. But at the same time, I think my own parents had sort of been through all the pressures of assimilation and trying their best to really hide what made them different, which of course as brown people it's much easier to do than as black people, and I think they'd been to a degree successful with that. So I think I wasn't sort of beholden by any specific cultural norms in a big way in my young life, but Islam definitely became a much bigger part of our collective family lives in the 2000s, which is, you know, just really interesting to think about what kind of sparked that.
Now, some very, very sketchy details reaching us here at Sky Centre. Important enough to bring to you, though, at this early stage. We believe that a plane has crashed into the World Trade Centre in New York. That happened within the last few moments. No details at this stage as to what sort of plane it is. It could well be...
Nabil, first, do you remember the day of the attack itself?
Yeah. I remember walking upstairs to my mum's room, and she just had the TV on, and she was just quiet. And then I asked her, what film is this? Because the scenes on the screen looked like something like Independence Day or, you know.
Right. Oh, my God. Another plane has just hit. It hit another building. Flew right into the middle of it. Explosion. My God, it's right in the middle of the building.
I've never seen a big building like that blown up. And also, you have to remember that this is so sad, but normally when you see explosions wiping out huge populations in real life, it's never in a Western country. So when I saw that, I assumed it was something from an action film. And my mom said that such and such just happened. I said, so what does that mean? She said, everything is going to change now. It was a weird time. It was scary, but I can remember that feeling of, yeah, life just changed.
So, Haima, you were quite young, but do you remember the day of the attack itself?
I don't think I have my own recollection. I mean, it's 2 days before my 7th birthday, I think. But you know when you have formed a memory based on other people telling you what they remember? And yeah. My mum always says that I had a friend round and we were playing in the living room and the TV was just on in the background. And then my mum says she came in and she sort of saw and she like told us to move out of the way and turn the volume up and whatnot.
When you can see these pictures, it's obviously something devastating has happened. And again, unconfirmed report that a plane...
I do remember, I guess, the image. I think that's what more sticks out in my mind. You could tell that was actually something a bit scary or a bit significant.
Can you remember how the people around you felt and what they said?
Yeah, I mean, I think my grandparents, my mum's side, they're from Pakistan. I think they've got their heads screwed on in the sense of like understanding how Western intervention works across the world. And so I think from very early on, they were just like, oh, well, you know what's going to happen now. They're going to go invade XYZ place. I do remember those discourses, and especially because I had younger uncles as well who were in their 20s at that time. And I feel like they'd gone through Chechnya, Bosnia, like the 90s. Mm. I think there was quite an anti-imperialist sentiment basically around more the repercussions and the impact of 9/11 than the event itself. And the other thing as well is that I guess seeing these brown bearded men, the only other place I'd really seen those images was obviously my family, but also being from Bradford and Leeds, earlier in 2001, you'd had the Bradford riots, right?
It began with an anti-Nazi rally in the city centre. The National Front had been planning their own demonstration. That didn't happen. But when word spread that National Front sympathisers had been seen in a nearby pub, the crowd broke ranks.
And you'd sort of had this image being shown as like, these are the scum of England, these Asian men, they need to be locked up. For me at that time and for my family as well, I think it was also figuring out like, okay, so who are we? Are we part of this? Are we these guys? And also I think really, if you think about Blair's speech about the moderate Muslims need to stand up.
To me, what this is in part about is empowering the moderate mainstream Muslim community to stand up and take on the extremists.
I don't remember that stuff, obviously, but I think what I do remember is the internalization of that as a Muslim child and as a member of a family. And I think maybe for my mum, that kind of led to her wanting to really look into Islam more. And I think for me and the rest of us also just really bought into that narrative of like going around telling everyone Islam means peace, Islam means peace, Islam means peace, which Islam doesn't mean peace, but it was a very convenient narrative, right? And I think it was very important for people that we distanced ourselves from what these guys had done.
Mm. Nabil, does any of that echo for you? Like, do you remember needing to sort of rehabilitate the image of Islam, even subconsciously, amongst my peers?
Hell no. I'm very happy to say that I never grew up around the get along, not in our name, halal cupcakes type Muslims. And that probably complicated things for me when I arrived in the UK because I refused to try and do the whole Islam is peace, brother thing that people do. Because to me, I think, one, no, it does not, rightfully said by Swayma. And two, it's like, when I first came to the UK, I remember there used to be Christians that would use 9/11 as proof of how bad Islam was. So I would end up getting into debates. I was more the confrontational type. I would not yield and accept responsibility for what happened and the things that unfortunately continued to happen because there was this sense, okay, but why is it when you guys do this to us, it's not part of your religion? It's not part of secularism. It's not part of your imperialist beliefs and culture.
I'm a bit older than you. I was an undergraduate doing American studies, and I very specifically remember watching Neighbours and then it cutting. I watched it happen, watched the second plane go in, and, you know, called my sister in America. We're all just in sort of devastated shock. And I was genuinely very fearful. I was very scared, scared for my family, scared for my parents, scared for just Muslims all over. And you had all these attacks on Muslims, on mosques. You had all the Sikhs that were attacked in the immediate aftermath. The long and short of that is, do you remember yourself, your family members facing any of that hostility in the immediate aftermath?
Yeah, after September 11th, I mean, moving here, I remember so many movements to get Muslims to train to be able to defend themselves and things like that. I can remember many situations where friends, relatives had been attacked. A family friend, his sister got attacked. Her ribs got broken, her jaw got broken. So these things happen. In fact, I still send out messages every September 11th and give people safety advice if they work in the city and things like that.
Wow, really?
Because these things, yeah, they still do happen. To be honest, I myself have had to physically intervene several times. So, like, whenever I'm on a train, I make a point of sitting, like, maybe not too far whenever I see a Muslim woman on the train. Just in case something happens, I might be able to help. It's sad, but it's something that's always at the back of my mind in certain scenarios. And I first became aware of those things when I came to the UK. Here, especially like hijab-wearing women, I don't envy you guys.
So, Haima, Nabil's talking about a particular anxiety around anniversaries, but I can imagine it's even worse after a terrorist attack.
I think being visibly Muslim, and it always feels awful because this is so selfish, but it goes, uh-oh, where am I? Do I need to be somewhere safe? That's stuck on my body. That's attached onto who I am as I'm walking down the street. Unfortunately, that's the thought process I have to go through. We know there's always spikes in Islamophobic incidents, which often target niqab-wearing and hijab-wearing women. And I have friends who, on days after attacks, they won't wear the hijab because they just feel so afraid and so vulnerable. The attacks makes you so hyper-visible.
Nabil, you mentioned that you moved to the UK in the years following 9/11. What was that like as a teenager? Was it much of a culture shock?
I could see the difference in my life in Nigeria and my life here immediately when I came here, because I grew up in the ninth highest population of Muslims in the world, where we were not second-class citizens. There was never this thing where you would go to school and teachers were spying on you. So that was one culture shock for me. And then two, having grown up in Nigeria, there was nothing wrong with being black or being brown. So to go from that to being a second-class citizen just because of the color of my skin, and then to be a religious minority, and then even within that religious minority, be a second-class citizen because I was black and not brown, these were issues that I had to contend with. So in a way, it was a shock. It was like a double shock.
And so, Haima, how about for you in those years post 9/11? Can you relate to what Nabil has said about this sort of sense of suspicion?
So at a subconscious level, rather than it being suspicion, I think as a brown girl, and I didn't start wearing a headscarf till year 8, so say when I was 12, up until then, I feel like I internalized the racism that is associated with young Asian girls, which is they're submissive, they're shy, they're probably oppressed by brothers, dads, some patriarch somewhere in their life. And I think I sort of formed my identity in opposition to that. So I was very much like, I need to prove at all times how clever I am, how funny I am, how sporty I am, how confident I am. And I always wanted teachers, I think, to see me as exceptional. You know, I'm not just like this generalized mass of people that you've associated me with, which I would later come to learn was a completely failed anti-racist strategy, which wouldn't save me from any of the kind of violence associated with being racialized. But I mean, later, I'd say when I was at university or even sixth form is when I think realizing there were certain ways you needed to have certain discussions became clearer to me. I remember distinctly after the Lee Rigby attack, I think I was in year 12, and I remember one of my friends, I think her brother was in the military, a white friend, and she was sort of saying how this was terrible and someone had attacked somebody who was a member of the military. And I just remember thinking, is there not a way to also say that, but the British military is also terrible? But I just remember that being the first time where I sort of thought, this is an opinion that could actually mark me as also suspicious as, you know, terrorist apologist, terrorist sympathiser. And when I started wearing hijab as well, I guess, in a way, I started wearing it very much, I think, also as a result of wanting to show that I'm an identifiable member of this group of people. And I'm proud. I'm not afraid of that. I'm not shy of kind of showing that. I think that was very much part of my personality at that time. But people did definitely dismiss me more easily, erase me more easily, overlook me more easily. And yet again, I think I was always trying to build my identity in opposition to what people thought I was, which is, yeah, an absolute waste of a childhood, I think, and really tragic.
You both have grown up as teenagers at a time where Islam has been portrayed as a uniquely violent and misogynistic religion. And in that space, who were your positive Muslim role models growing up?
Just all the people around me. I think the role models in my life were my uncle, my mum, my grandma. And to be honest, back when I was a kid as well, you couldn't switch on Britain's Got Talent and Sina Beale. Like, you're not going to have Muslims on.
Oh, stop it. You're making me blush.
I think Riz Ahmed was probably one of the only people who was on.
Post 9/11, I've been getting paid. Playing terrorists on telly, getting songs made. But will it get airplay, Giza? If BBC don't want it, I'll send it to Al Jazeera. Yeah. Everybody
do the... But that was even then when I was like teenager. Honestly, like, I remember one of the most inspiring events I ever went to when I was a teenager was a local community centre. They had Muazzam Bey come and speak about his experiences being held in Guantanamo Bay. And to me, that was like, oh my God, the world is corrupt. I remember my big refrain during my teens was, how can that be legal? I remember I watched the Malcolm X film when I was probably like, I don't know, 12, 13. And I started praying the next day.
But I have eaten from the same plate, drunk from the same glass, and prayed to the same God with fellow Muslims whose eyes were blue, whose hair was blonde, and whose skin was the whitest of white. And we were all brothers, truly.
Yeah, I was like, okay, cool. We need to just change our lives. We all need to be like Malcolm X. Nowadays, a lot of noise is made about representation and let's have a Muslim on this thing and that thing. Let's have a hijabi in this thing and that thing. But like, honestly, that's never going to make our lives safer, right? And I think for me, that's my measurement. It's like, will this protect us from having our homes raided? Will this protect us from being stopped at the border? Will this protect us from our kids being surveilled? And no, it won't.
Nabil, how about yourself? Like, it sounds like you don't even need any sort of positive examples of what being a Muslim is in this context. You're very much your own guy.
I'm not that conceited. But I mean, obviously, when you're as cool as me. No, you know, if you don't answer Malcolm X, you're just lying.
Mm.
Especially as a black Muslim. The Black Panther political party, Sheikh Amadou Bamba, you know, so many anti-imperialist Muslims that have existed over time inspire me. But the reality is, ultimate inspiration will always be the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, because there's nothing that we're going through that he didn't see worse of and that he didn't warn us about. And it's painful what's happening, but again, my people have been through worse. I think, in a way, Islam has always been normalized for me because I'm a hip-hop fan as well. It's always been cool to be Muslim. A lot of my favorite rappers were Muslim. You got Big Daddy Kane.
So let's groove with the smooth operator.
Rakim. Busta Rhymes is a Muslim. Ice Cube's always been Muslim.
No small. And mama cooked the breakfast.
Mos Def has always been Muslim. He's just more practicing now. Even if they were not the best examples of Islam, I just think that black Muslims in the West have done a good job of representing themselves as Muslims and not terrorists. Not that we need to, but like, it's never been hard for me to look out and see examples of normal Muslim people in terms of representation. Britain as a whole is a bit behind when it comes to stuff like media. And I'm not saying media representation makes a huge difference, but I'm not going to lie, it makes some, because these things have a mental impact. And part of the reason I do what I do and I speak about the things that I speak about is because I hope that at least one person is watching and is like, oh, finally. And that's why I will always bring my faith into what I do. Even though I'm not perfect, at least I represent something.
So Jaime, you studied at Cambridge and SOAS, and in that time became a poet and an activist, if I understand it rightly. What's that journey been like?
What I would say is, if anybody ever asked where I was radicalised, tell them Cambridge University, because I was exposed there first time to the unbearable systemic white supremacy that is so sort of insidious in this country. You know, I realised, Jaime, it doesn't matter how clever you are, how funny you are, how sporty, XYZ, whatever you do, people are still going to come up to you and ask you about Charlie Hebdo. They're going to still ask you about Palestine. They're still going to ask you about freedom of speech, Trojan horse, all these things that happened while I was at uni. And I think at first poetry was just a way for me to express myself. It was just that I needed to get this out, like these thoughts I was having. And at the time, I was also part of an organization, FLY, which was for women of color and non-binary people. That was where I basically was exposed to a lot of radical thoughts in terms of anti-racism. I think that stuff changed me a lot. And it made me also realize like what a farce the whole aim high, pull yourself up by your bootstrap stuff had been. Because you have to remember, I was fully into all of that. I got to Cambridge, that's the height of assimilation, right? Like this is what all immigrant grandparents would be wanting for you. So leaving there, I continued with the poetry. I enjoyed that. I was doing my master's looking into prevent counter-terror legislation. And then the London Bridge attack happened. And I was lined up to be part of a national poetry slam final that week at the Roundhouse. And I just thought, oh God, I'm going to step on that stage and people will... The way I imagine it is that there's all these comic bubbles that pop up around me. And it's every headline you've ever seen associated with Muslim women. And so in a way, I was like, oh God, should I talk about the attack? Should I not talk about the attack? And so I started writing this poem that was basically just like a huge apology. It was like, oh, not all Muslims are bad. We're also nice sometimes and we're funny. And the more that I wrote it, the more I realized what was actually happening. I realized, you know, I'm essentially conceding to the idea that my humanity is conditional and that you can kind of burden me with this collective guilt because of who I am. So the eventual poem I wrote was kind of just like saying that I completely don't adhere to that.
Can you share some lines from that poem?
Tell them how you also cry at the end of Toy Story 3.
So I'm sort of going through like, oh, I was going to write this poem.
You're just as capable of bantering about the weather in the post office queue. Like everyone, you have no idea how to make the perfect amount of pasta still.
And then I say, but no, this will not be a Muslims are like us poem. I refuse to be respectable. Instead, love us when we're lazy, love us when we're poor, love us in our back-to-backs, council estates, depressed, unwashed and weeping, love us high as kites, unemployed, joyriding, time-wasting, failing at school, love us filthy, without right colour passports, without the right sounding English, love us violent, unapologising, silent and sometimes suicidal. And then the kind of the punchline is that I say, if you need me to prove my humanity, I'm not the one that's not human.
I'm not the one that's not human. My mother texts me too. After
I think you can create a lot of collective consciousness raising through poetry. And I think that's a big part of what I hope to do, spread ideas, spread questions and provocations that make people think more carefully. And that's not just Muslims. That's anyone who wants to think. That's anyone who wants to really like change our conditions from the conditions that we're currently living in.
Nabil, over to you. You've been working as a comedian for years since university, but your big mainstream breakthrough was cracking up the judges on Britain's Got Talent last year, and you made it all the way to the final and came fourth. Can you tell me about the set that you chose for that show?
So, yeah, I built like a small but loyal cult following, but I was never the mainstream guy. And when I went on Britain's Got Talent, I just thought, you know what, I'm just going to do it my way.
Hi, what's your name?
Hi, my name's Nabil Abdulrasheed, and I'm from Croydon, South London. I'm not going to water myself down, because if I do get any benefit from this, there'll be no point, because people who come to see me later might run away in shock and horror when they see what I'm actually like. So I went on, and I think my audition, I mean, there's lots of stuff that didn't make through the edit. But what made it through the edit to me, even that was shocking, because I had jokes about prevent and the Home Office.
The annoying thing about being Muslim in 21st century Britain is you know the MI5, prevent and Home Office listening on your phone calls, but they don't go halves on the bill. They follow you on Twitter, they don't retweet. They follow you on Facebook, but they don't poke. Well, not on Facebook, they poke you at the airport.
I talked about the microaggressions that Muslims suffer working in office environments and things like that. And it went through. And then when I went through to the semi-final, a different part of me was also under attack, my blackness, because we had the killing of the brother in America, George Floyd, and there were riots. And most comedians who've been on Britain's Got Talent go on and do old material. the best hits and hope for the best. But for me, because I view my comedy as a service to my community as well as art, I decided to go and do stuff based on what was happening at the time.
You think I came out here and said something really inflammatory, like Winston Churchill was black? By the way, he was. I can prove it. You don't believe me? When was the last time you met a white man named Winston?
So I talked about the riots, I talked about police brutality, and I talked about Islamophobia and how Muslims were being blamed somehow for the spread of COVID and all these things.
I said, no, right, you see Muslims trying to sneak in your Halloween meat to our shops. I said, you mean halal? He said, that's the one, oi, oi. Halal, shmala, ramadam, jin, dog, come on.
And it worked.
More than 3,000 people complained overall about your appearances on Britain's Got Talent. How did you deal with that? What did you think of it?
Fire burned them. Listen, half of them were probably from the same person anyway, in his mum's basement somewhere. I'm no stranger to people attacking me online. As much laughter and love and joy that I spread, for some strange reason, there's always one or two groups of people that just don't seem to like me. And they're not always non-Muslim either. But at the end of the day, if I trigger something in you by speaking the truth, that means I've done my job. Spicy food, you either like it or it burns you. So that's all it was.
Okay, so you've both had a fair bit of artistic success, and in your work, you've both drawn the treatment of Muslims in wider society. But the past 20 years has seen some big legal changes which have disproportionately affected Muslims. From control orders, which kept people under house arrest, to the attempt to introduce 48-day detention without trial, which broke all legal precedent. So many Muslim men I know have been repeatedly, randomly selected in the airport for searches. And then there's most recently the government's anti-terror programme, Prevent, which has been put under review for the way it impacts young Muslim children. How do you think all of that has affected your identity as a British Muslim?
Absolutely, massively. I mean, in 2017, I had this poem that went viral, like 2 million views. And I was contacted by this one outlet called This Is Woke. And they were like, look, let's make a film together. Let's do this, let's do that. And then mysteriously just disappeared. I didn't think anything of it. 2 years later, I found out they were a Home Office run operation. And they were basically looking for grassroots voices to find out if they were amenable to put out government propaganda. You know, I remember at university, this was just after Prevent had become statutory in 2015. It was after the Charlie Hebdo attack. And I was trying to arrange an event called Politics of Grief, where we were actually going to talk about why is it that lives are so grievable in the West, but not in other places. I tried to book the room and I was told very kindly, you know, maybe someone else should book this room in their name. You know, it might just be a bit easier to book the room. And so I think this all stems back from legislation, which assumes that all Muslims are predisposed to violence. All Muslims are on a conveyor belt, basically, to at some point perpetrate an act of violence. And so I think had I been a boy, like if I'd been my brother, I think that would have also manifested differently. But as a girl and as a young woman, I think it manifested in the state trying to co-opt. A few months ago, I did a subject access request. So that's where you can get information about you from the Home Office. And I was just interested to see what have they got. And it's fascinating because in this access request form, there's mentions of me in internal Home Office emails. There's mentions of me in extremism analysis unit reports. So you kind of recognize that actually, as much as we had these fears that we were being surveilled growing up, you know, as much as we had these fears as teenagers that, oh, even if jokingly, oh, is your phone tapped? Like, don't talk about this in front of this person or whatever. We are being surveilled and we are being monitored and we are being watched. And so I think I almost feel like it's impossible to account for just how significantly that's shaped who many of us are today. When I think about my peers, I think for some of us, it made us politically docile and very much afraid to voice opinions and not wanting to have any kind of political voice. And I think for the rest of us, it made us very much the opposite, you know, that actually this is something we are going to resist at all costs and we're going to talk about it and we're going to expose it. But in either case, it's made us, I think, the people we are today.
Nabil, how much do you relate to what Sahima said?
Yeah, it's pretty much the same. I actually want to put in a similar request, see how much I'm being watched. And by the way, if this is being recorded by anyone but you guys, Islam is peace. I remember people who would post things online to try and entrap people. That was a big thing in forums. And you could always tell. It's a lot like when they sent undercover police to the ends.
So entrap them how? You mean like to try and see if you can draw out some extremist sympathies and then one step to the next?
You see, like from how you're talking right now, you sound like one of them. Like I will get an inbox message saying, brother, why ain't you talking about jihad? Are you scared? Right? And you check and it's like a profile with his name spelt in bullets. Or it's that one picture of a dude with a sword on a horse, right? With names like Abu Jihad Ibn Brixton, right? You know, the Facebook pages that never get taken down, that post all this violent stuff and encourage violence. Blatantly government-run pages. But in all seriousness, you know, every time I travel, they have a look at my passport. They give me a look. It can't be normal to live like this. We probably are festering some form of trauma from the kind of experiences that we have at the hands of the multiple governments that we have to exist in. It's gotten to the point where I don't remember what life was like when I didn't have these worries. It's a very painful thought process for me now as a father. My children have to learn to almost code switch in a way from early so that they don't arouse suspicion in schools and get taken away. Like, this is a reality that is unique to Muslim children. So I have to have the talk with my kids. How much do I tell them? How much do I hide from them?
Coming up, 20 years on from the attack, how have things changed? In 2021, 20 years have passed since 9/11, Muslims are much more visible. We have actors, performers, writers known worldwide. London has a Muslim mayor. There's more representation on screen, in culture, with fashion houses. Equally, at the same time, the very term Islamophobia itself is contested, and there is still a very pedantic debate on whether it should still be considered a form of racism. Do you think Islamophobia has changed in the time since you've been growing up to where you are now?
I think Islamophobia has just more deeply entrenched itself. And as a response to that, you've had all these kind of ridiculous and like reductive denials and dismissals. But I think the denial and dismissal around Islamophobia even existing is just proof of kind of how ubiquitous it has become. It's the air that you breathe. We all understand and know Muslims are savages, Muslims are uncivilized, Muslims are misogynists, they're patriarchs, they're paedophiles, they're rapists, they're submissive. You can't deny that that is just part and parcel of the standard narrative. You're not even seen as racist for believing any of that, right? You know, you can be talking to your lovely friendly neighbor and they'll say that, you know, oh, it's so awful how Muslim women are all oppressed. And that's just standard, right? That's not seen as Islamophobic. So to me, it's ubiquitous.
Nabil, what do you think?
I don't understand how anyone can argue that Islamophobia does not exist. I remember I got called on a TV interview and I said that Islamophobia was a problem. And he said, well, Islamophobia can't be a problem because Islam isn't a physical thing for you to hate. And I said, that's like saying homophobia isn't a problem because homosexuality isn't a tangible thing for someone to hate. It's normalized to spread fake news and false information through official avenues about Islam. It's the fact that we've got political parties being put under review and scorn and fire for hating one religious group. Whereas we've got a ruling party right now that has openly done things that show that they hate Muslims in their actions and in their words. And there's no inquiry, there's no justice, there's no outrage in that. That in itself says all you need to know. Islamophobia goes beyond just a prejudice that people have now. It's become a culture, it's become an industry. It's even become a talking point among so-called anti-racists who use Islamophobia as an excuse to hate. So like, oh, it's because they care about Muslim women so much that they support things that attack the faith of the women who they claim they're trying to help.
I mean, it's a bleak assessment, but I have to ask you both, is there anything that you feel optimistic about? I mean, for future generations of young Muslims, this post-9/11 generation, do you think that they could possibly avoid going through some of the things that we've talked about today?
I mean, look, listen, as a Muslim, optimism, I think, is, you know, I'm not hoping for this world. There's that saying that our honour does not lie with mankind, it lies with Allah. And I think that honestly, all the optimism that I derive is from having that hope that actually this is not the be all and end all. This world is not the only place. And I think if I didn't have that, God, I would be overwhelmed with despair. But yeah, the optimism is that I think we have more and more avenues to fight for justice and to resist and to really, I think, live Islam. We have really good opportunities to see, can we be the Muslims that we hope to be? Can we live Muslimness as a practice and not just as an identity? And so when I do meet young Muslims and they talk to me, they all have a lot of fire. I think it's that freedom that comes with having nothing to lose. It's that we're the menace of the world. Nobody likes us. And so in that sense, there's nothing to prove. Therefore, we can actually just strive for what we believe in, which is that it is incumbent upon us to seek justice on this earth, and that the reward for that is not in this world. And therefore, you don't need to worry about, okay, well, are things going to get better before I die? Inshallah, they will. Let's hope that they will. But if not, it's cool. Like, this world is not the be-all and end-all. So that's where I get my optimism, I think.
That was beautiful.
It was.
Mashallah, sister.
Nabil, you must feel optimistic for your kids. Come on.
My view of things is a bit more blasé, but I think things will always exist like this to some degree. And there will be some trade-offs. So, like, there will be prevents, but, hey, more places will be halal. And there will be more Muslims in our schools teaching openly, blah, blah, blah. But, oh, every now and then, someone's going to get their head kicked in on a Friday or something. That's just life. Nothing is new under the sun. Everything repeats itself. Things will continue as they are.
That's the best we can hope for.
There's highs, there's going to be lows. I don't see things improving because too many of the things that make life hell for us happen to make billions of dollars for other people.
Mm.
But at the same time, mm-hmm. they'll never get rid of us all, because then who will they have to blame for things? But Subway's halal.
Both of you, it's such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much, Nabil. Thank you so much, Sahima.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun.
Thanks for having me, man.
That was Nabil Abdul-Rashid and Sahima Manzoor Khan. My thanks to them. Do check out Sahima's poetry collection, Postcolonial Banter, and catch Nabil live on his current tour. A statement given to Today in Focus by Cambridge University read, "Harassment of any kind is not tolerated by Cambridge University. Cambridge is committed to creating a supportive and inclusive environment for all its students, regardless of their background. In 2020, more than one in four students were from an ethnic minority background, and more than 70% of students were from state schools." And in another statement, a spokesperson for the Home Office said, "Islamophobia has no place in our society, and we continue to work closely with community groups, charities, and schools funding projects to tackle racially and religiously motivated hatred. The Prevent programme continues to play a vital role in directing people vulnerable to radicalisation down a safe path. It deals with all forms of terrorism and does not focus on any single community. It is categorically not true that the Home Office runs social media profiles encouraging violent extremism to entrap potential extremists." Ahead of tomorrow's anniversary, we've been exploring the impact of 9/11 on British Muslims. But for an exploration of what life has been like for Muslims living in the US, make sure to book tickets on gu.com/Guardian Live for a fantastic live stream panel discussion hosted by The Guardian US next Thursday, September the 16th. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Rudy Zagadlo. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Archie Bland. We'll be back on Monday.